This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
Miles de personas.
Realidad concreta. Thousands of people. The concrete truth, raw, fleeing their country, fleeing crime, insecurity, fleeing the lack of jobs,
hombres,
men,
mujeres,
women,
niños,
children.
You're listening to sound from a Facebook Live video of a caravan of migrants marching their way north from Honduras this week. Last Friday, the group included 160 people. Today, there could be as many as 4,000. Many of them are trying to reach the United States, but all of them say they're fleeing an increasingly desperate situation, like this Honduran mother who was interviewed by Plaza Pública, a Guatemalan news organization.
There is nothing more difficult than waking up in the morning with your child saying, "Mom, I'm hungry." And then you begin counting your cents to see how you're going to buy him some juice. Meanwhile, the big business owners throw their food away.
President Trump has urged Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, known as the Northern Triangle, to stop the people from traveling north, threatening to pull funding to those countries. On Twitter today, he also threatened the use of military force. But the migrants continue their journey. Reports emerged Wednesday that a second caravan is also organizing with hundreds of migrants traveling from southern Honduras. I'm joined now by two journalists covering these caravans closely. Nina Lacani and Sarah Kanosian are both freelance reporters covering Mexico and Central America. And they both join me now from Mexico City. Nina and Sarah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Nina, let's start with you. What's the latest on the two migrant caravans that I described earlier? Where are they coming from, and are they mostly men, children, women? Who are in these caravans?
Last night, around 4,000 people slept in and around Guatemala City. So they're the ones you'd call the first caravan, though it's sort of grown gradually over the last 5 days. There's a mix of people. There are entire families, parents, grandparents, children, single parents with their kids, unaccompanied teenagers or teenagers who are traveling with relatives or friends. There's single men. There's at least one person in a wheelchair. There's pregnant women. So it's a real mix of people. And they mostly slept in and around Guatemala City last night and will be making their way towards the Mexican border today. We're not sure if that's going to happen as one big group or they're going to leave in small groups in waves. So that's the first caravan. Then in Honduras, we have hundreds of people gathering in different points of the country, I understand. I know in the north last night in La Ceiba, several hundred people were gathering and planning to leave either late last night or early this morning. What we had happen yesterday was around 500 people from Choluteca, which is in the southern part of Honduras, which has been ravaged by climate change and coastal destruction, arrived at the Guatemalan border, but were refused entry. There was a whole wall of riot police that refused to let them pass, which is absolutely illegal. I mean, there is a migration agreement between four Central American countries, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, which allows people free movement as long as they have their national ID card. But the Guatemalan authorities were demanding passports. Very few Hondurans have passports, and they were denied entry. So they, I understand, slept sort of near the border last night and will try again today. I imagine when they're joined by the rest of the people who are gathering around the country.
Nina, can you tell us what the conditions are in Honduras that are forcing people to leave the country?
It's a toxic mix of extreme poverty, violence, corruption, and almost total impunity. There was a coup in 2009, since when hundreds of thousands of people from Honduras have been forced to leave or been forcibly displaced because they cannot make enough money to feed their families. You know, the basic salary, the minimum wage, does not buy a basket of food. You know, they call it the canasta básica, which is, you know, your main sort of basic items that anyone would need to keep their families going. It doesn't cover that. And on top of that, you have uniforms for school, you know, basic sort of equipment. The health system has collapsed. It's collapsed because it's been bankrupt in, you know, through corruption. The education system is failing. And then you have, you know, extreme violence. You have gangs in the urban areas, which I talked about a lot, and causing, you know, misery in communities. But you also have state-sponsored violence. You have paramilitary groups. You have other types of organized crime groups. And the state is implicated in a large amount of this violence, and there is almost total impunity. So where do people go? You know, when I was looking at those images yesterday of people not being allowed to cross, you're trapping in people inside a country which is like, you know, creating this huge jail, not allowing them to leave and escape extreme violence and poverty.
Sarah, I want to bring you in here. President Trump threatened to cut aid to Honduras earlier this week. Last year, the U.S. gave about $180 million to that country. What kind of programs does the U.S. fund, and are they effective?
Yeah, so out of the $181 million, about $30 million went to borders and drugs, counter-narcotics operations. $65.5 million around there went to more domestic security, so that's justice sector reform, police reform, violence prevention. Around $55 million goes to education, small business, agriculture, and $31.5 million goes supposedly to improving institutions, transparency, and human rights.
You said supposedly, meaning?
I mean, a lot of the aid is directed at improving institutions, you know, in terms of looking at the counter-narcotics. You know, there's $14 million going through the Department of Defense and $10 million more going to drug interdiction. But I think, I mean, even within that aid, there's certain questions that are raised to the efficacy of it. The current defense minister, the current police chief, and the president's own brother have all been implicated in drug trafficking. So that, you know, that calls into the efficacy of some of the aid that we're spending on counter-narcotics operations. But, you know, a large part of the aid is directed supposedly at addressing some of the root causes that Nina had mentioned. So cutting off aid to some of these efforts, you know, could stifle some of the initiatives that are, you know, directed at trying to address some of those problems.
And Sarah, the United States has a big military presence in Honduras. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, currently, you know, there's a major military base called the Sotocana Air Base that has 500 to 600 troops, and it's the hub of all counter-narcotics operations in Central America. But, you know, Honduras is one of the U.S.'s closest allies in the region, if not the closest militarily. It's always had a pretty close relationship. In the 1980s, it served as a staging ground for the U.S.'s covert war against communism in Latin America. You know, it's where they trained right-wing forces for operations in El Salvador and Nicaragua. You know, and then you bring that up into today, where it's the closest ally in Central America, where it receives the most aid.
I want to play a clip from Mike Pence. Just a day before the caravan set out from Honduras, the vice president spoke at a conference on security, and here's what he had to say.
We also need all the nations in the region to reinforce a very simple message to your people. And it's a message from the heart. And that is, don't put your families at risk by taking the dangerous journey north to attempt to enter the United States illegally. If they can't come to the United States legally, they should not come at all.
Nina, what's your response to Pence's comments?
Desperate people do desperate things. None of these people have undertaken this grueling journey, almost 3,000 miles from home, because, you know, it's something they fancy doing for fun. They're doing it because they see no other choice. And they've all left together because they see safety in numbers. You know, Mexico is one of the most dangerous migration passages in the world. There are multiple risks, and they feel that if they come together, they may stand a better chance of making it alive to the US border. So whatever Mike Pence says, the families who have left together, they're going to just try. You know, I've had so many people say to me over the years, well, you know, I'd rather try dying than stay in Honduras and die of hunger or die because a gang kills me. I'm just going to give it a shot.
And I'm wondering how many of those folks are watching what's happening with the president's, President Trump's family separation policy, the potential for this to happen again. Is that of concern at all, Nina?
I think they will know about it, you know, but I think they will also be thinking, but hang on, my neighbor got over the border last year. I have a cousin that managed to make it. Maybe I'll be lucky. You know, that's how desperate people are. They're going on the whim and the prayer, you know. They think, hang on, I do know people that have got across. I do know people that were, you know, were detained and were deported, but maybe I'll be one of the lucky ones and it's worth giving it a try.
Sarah, I'm wondering about the concerns about the Mexican government and whether they will attempt to repress the current migrants that are coming up. Are you hearing any of that in Mexico City?
Well, yesterday, the Mexican government sent more troops down to the border, and Mexico has deported even more Central Americans than the United States, despite what President Trump may, you know, say on his Twitter feed. The Mexican government has deported thousands more migrants back to Central America. And so it remains to be seen if there's going to be sort of a standoff or, like as Nita had mentioned before, if people are going to be splitting up into smaller groups, which would definitely change the dynamic.
I'm also wondering, you know, we often assume that when folks are migrating from this region, they're migrating to the United States, regardless of the political climate. And I'm wondering, are there other countries or other places that migrants would consider, given the current political climate in the United States?
Since 2014, you know, when the Southern Front plan was launched, that happened after the humanitarian crisis was announced, and it just became much more perilous to make that journey through Mexico. You know, there was a huge increase in Mexican migration agents. People will be detained and deported, not just at the southern border, but all through the country. At that point, Mexico, you know, really started to convert from a transit country into a destination country. And how we measure that is by the number of people who were asking for asylum in Mexico just from 2014 to last year. I think it's quadrupled. And I think that that's another important point. Lots of the people who are in that caravan, I'm sure, would qualify for refugee status under international law. You know, so they're not all economic migrants. You know, huge numbers of these people are actually fleeing death threats, imminent threats to their lives, and they would qualify for refugee status. And we've seen that many people have been asking for refugee status in Mexico. You have seen that happen in Belize, for example. There's been a big increase in Salvadorans, and specifically Salvadorans and Guatemalans, because during the civil wars in the 1980s and 90s, Belize was a destination country for those two nations. In Costa Rica, you have seen some increase, but it's been mainly Nicaraguans fleeing the repression by the Ortega regime. But Mexico, Belize, for sure.
Nina Lacani and Sarah Kenossian are both freelance reporters covering Mexico and Central America. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.